Welcome, everybody, back to the Pittsburgh Oddcast. My name is Andrew Lindberg. I'm the producer of the program. And with me, as always, is the founder of Odd Pittsburgh, John Chalkowski.
Well, hello. So today, we have a special guest in studio. And when I say special guest, I see this phone? I'm going to show you a trick. Okay.
Let's see it.
You see it. Now you don't. And that's a magician and illusionist and escape artist extraordinaire. And I don't know how much more we could keep on adding and adding to your resume, really.
Thank you, man.
Lee Turbosik.
Thank you. Thanks. Good to be with you guys.
Thanks for coming on the Oddcast. So, first, let's step back a little bit. I'm going to talk about the first time I was conscious of who you were.
Okay.
I get an email from the city of Pittsburgh, tagging me and, copying you, I think, talking about this kind of crazy idea to kind of recreate an extremely dangerous stunt in the middle of downtown Pittsburgh, upside down in a straitjacket, on the exact 100th anniversary of the day that Houdini himself did it. And I'm like, well, who's this guy?
Yeah.
I need to find out who this is. So immediately I sent you some cool whatever I had at the time.
I remember that actually.
And then
through Facebook,
you know,
I believe.
And some photos of Houdini here, and including the one of him hanging upside down.
Yep.
And then same thing with just the dates of times that he came through, because a lot of people don't realize that Houdini himself did come to Pittsburgh
a lot
often.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then this first time we met in person.
Yeah.
It was one of my favorite stories to tell anybody. And we were standing in line to see the orchestral recreation of the score for Back to the Future 2.
Oh, I love Back to the Future, man. I wasn't missing that.
Yeah. We were in line at, it was the first Back to the Future, I believe. Yeah. One of them.
Yeah, it was the first one.
Yeah. And we were in line at Heinz Hall.
Both great music.
Yeah.
Alan Silvestri, man. Yeah. You can't go wrong, right? But the, sure enough, now you were standing in front of me, and I did not know that was you at the time, but then in front of you was just some other random kid, like a random person.
Yeah, I remember this now, yeah.
Who's
this young kid doing card tricks to his friend.
Yeah, starts showing his friends, like, these card tricks, like, hey, you want to see a cool trick, you know?
And he did one for me.
They turned around,
yeah,
exactly.
And he was like, hey, man, can I show you a trick? And I was like, yeah, dude, do it, man. And I was, like, loving it, you know, because I was, like, just seeing this kid do it, because it reminded me of me, in a way.
Right.
And then when the kid was done, you know, he did a nice trick. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, hey, can I show you guys one?
Yeah, you, like, whip out a pack of cards.
I used their cards,
right,
I think.
Yeah.
I think I used their cards.
Yeah.
And I did something, you know, crazy, mm-hmm. and blew their minds. Like,
yeah.
And then, like, this kid was like,
I've never seen someone's mind being blown.
This kid was
so
like,
much.
Yeah, he was like, wait, who are you?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And I wasn't there for that, but that's one of my favorite stories that John tells.
Yeah. Thanks, man. Thank you.
I mean, yeah, it was like,
yeah, then I hit him back the cards, and I was like, and then we just went right, and then we got like right into the theater.
Yeah.
And like, I don't think I ever,
yeah, exactly,
let that kid know, but
right, yeah, so. So that was fantastic. that's how the first kind of way I met into you. And then, of course, that led eventually to the 2016
performance. Yeah.
Performance,
Houdini 100.
You know?
Yeah. That was a fun one to put together.
Oh, I can imagine.
I discovered the image that I replicated from Houdini that was taken in 1916 on that November 6th at Wooden Liberty.
Mm-hmm.
I discovered that photo in 2010.
Wow.
In a book called the Taschen Magic Book.
Wow.
Now, the crazy backstory behind that book is that day I was in New York City. Okay. It was a Sunday. That weekend, I had helped my mentor, Paul Gertner, run his magic show in Manhattan.
Wow.
And on Sunday, we were about to come back to Pittsburgh. And Paul, at the last moment, he goes, Lee, he goes, before we head back, do you want to see if we can find Harry Houdini?
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, what do you mean, Paul? He's like, I think he's buried around here. Mm-hmm. And I was like, sure. So we got in the car and we like went up to Queens and figured it out and found his grave.
Wow.
Went and we hung out at Harry Houdini's grave.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about magic history and, like, you know, magicians from our past. And then we just came back to Pittsburgh right after. Right? And all the way home, we were just talking about that. And then we got to his house. Paul was like, hey, I had this new book, this Taschen book that just came out in the magic community. He's like, here, I want you to have a copy because I bought three of them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he had these three sitting in his garage. He gave me one of them. I went home, and that night is when I opened the book, and I found that photo. And
wow.
I could not believe it. I was like, I can't believe this is real.
Right.
I can't believe this is Houdini, and this is saying Pittsburgh.
Right.
And then immediately I was like, how do I find out more information about this photo? And that's when I started, I called Rick Seebeck.
Mm-hmm.
And Rick was so kind. He was like, yeah, he told me everything he knew about it. And then we ended up connecting, and then we started to, like, take the photo and go around Pittsburgh and figure out the exact location.
Mm-hmm.
And once we were able to, like, pinpoint all the information, it was like, I now had all this details. That was when I started the process of saying, all right, I'm going to recreate this in 2016, which was 5 years away.
Wow.
And it was like over the next 5 years, I had to figure it all out.
Yeah.
And that was the challenge for me. And I, you know, occasionally I would tell people like, hey, I'm going to do this thing in 16. You should come check it out if you remember. And people were like, you're out of your mind, bro. Like, really? You're gonna hang upside down in a straitjacket and escape. And they're like, how are you going to? And I was like, I will do it. You will see this. I promise. Right. And then when it got closer and it got closer, you know, it just got more fun to create.
Mm-hmm.
And then the day I did it, you know, we had the whole city rolled out for it. It was incredible. We had Franco there and Rocky Blyer. I invited Rocky because of his connection to Appleton, Wisconsin.
Oh, wow.
You know, because originally when Harry Houdini came to the United States in 1878 from Budapest, he came through Ellis Island, but he ended up settling in Appleton, Wisconsin.
Wow.
And he always would claim as Appleton as his where he was born, but that was a lie.
Yeah, yeah.
He lied about that for the longest time because he was so pro-American.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't want people to know that he was an immigrant.
Right, Hungarian.
So. So that was like kind of that's how that story kind of like unraveled for me.
Wow.
Over those 5 years was like piecing it together and like trying to just figure out how to make it work for that big day, and hopefully pray to God that I get good weather.
yeah, exactly. I'm doing a lightning storm.
Yeah, I know. Man. I rolled the dice hard on that. Though.
Yeah, for sure. So, what is it about Harry Houdini in particular? Not necessarily. Well, I'm sure all magic, really. Well, but
I think it comes back to like when every magician starts in magic. I mean, you learn about the greats, and the greatest of all time is Harry. So, of course, you're like, okay, well, this guy did it the best. Let me explore him, you know, let me figure out why he was the greatest. And I think every young magician goes through that, you know, because it's so important to learn where this art came from and who was the best at it and who carried it and took it in new directions. And as a kid, I talk about this on stage, how, you know, some kids grow up with posters of Michael Jordan on their walls. I just happened to be the kid that had Harry Houdini. You know,
awesome.
I had the poster of the King of Cards. You know, I was staring at that as a 10-year-old and thinking about, like, you know, how can I have, in some way, shape, or form, a career in magic?
Mm-hmm.
And so as a young kid looking at that and loving that and wanting to explore that every day, that's what kept me going. It was that my love for Harry Houdini and my love for just the art of itself. And so 27 years later, I'm still doing it.
Yeah. Now you grew up in like near Pittsburgh, Baldwin, right?
I grew up in Lincoln Place, actually.
Okay.
So I was I was a city kid
up
until I was 13. And then I had to make a decision because I went to a Catholic grade school early on, St. Albert the Great. And I had to make a decision whether or not I wanted to go to Alderdice with some of my friends, or did I want to go to Carrick? Or because, you know, I live in the city, so I had a couple of choices. I could have continued to stay in Catholic school with like Sarah or those, but a lot of my friends were going to Baldwin, and I at the time was really big into soccer and track and athletics.
Right.
And I knew that I wanted to someday play college ball, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, and this was me being, you know, thinking so far ahead at that age, I was like, I'd rather play in a WPIAL at a quad A school than play in the city league.
well, that was
my thought process behind
right,
that.
Right, yeah.
And so my parents were like, okay, well then we'll move to Baldwin. And I went to Baldwin High School, graduated from there in 01, and then I went on to Robert Morris University as well.
Nice.
Did that love of magic ever wane, like especially in your teenage years?
Yes, it did, but not for long periods. I'd always get sucked back into it. Like, but there would be those times where, when I would stop performing magic for a few weeks because I was going to soccer camp, you know? And it's like, I would do a couple tricks down at soccer camp, but it wasn't like I was doing it when I was always performing.
Right.
You know, when you get into high school, you discover girls, and it's like, you know, maybe the girls don't think this is the coolest thing, you know? So maybe I don't try to do magic tricks for girls,
you know?
Yeah,
little do they know.
But little do they know, no. But then, you know, when I got into the full dating scene where I could take a girl out on a date and drive, you know, that's when I looked at magic and I was like, I guarantee I can get a second call. I can get the second date. And this is how I used it. I would be on a date, and I would make the salt shaker disappear from the table, and I would never bring it back, okay? And then what I would do is I would make the salt shaker. When the girl would get home and she'd go in her house, right, I'd drop her off, She'd open her purse, and inside would be the salt shaker. Mm-hmm. And of course, she's calling me, going, "How the hell did you get the salt shaker in my purse? Or how? You know, when you made it disappear, how did you do?" And of course, I'm saying, "I'm not telling you, but if you want to see more, you got to go on a second date, right?" And so I, you know, magic became not only part of my social life, but it also became part of my, in a way, my education, because I was incorporating magic into every project, any type of presentation. I was putting a magic spin on it, so I was always customizing it. That's what kept it fun for me. That's what kept me, in a way, doing it through high school and the talent shows.
I'm one of those people that when I see a magician, I don't try to figure out how they're doing it. I want to be I want the suspense and the suspension of disbelief. I mean, magic is obviously not real, but maybe it is. But
I'm not saying.
How long did it take you to hone your craft?
Long time. I'm talking thousands and thousands of hours that are spent specifically on like certain moves. I mean, just to shuffle a pack of cards with like one hand, you know, I'm looking at a couple hundred hours of practice just to master that technical skill of a sleight just with my fingers. And then it becomes muscle memory after you do it 1,000 times, you know, and now I can do it, you know, I can close, you know, being sleeping, I'm doing one-handed shuffles with a deck of cards and I'm rolling coins on my knuckles and stuff like that. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot of time spent on the technical aspect of it, like just how a musician is learning to play a piano.
That's what I was going to say, because I come from a music background.
Absolutely, it's the same process.
It sounds like the same thing.
And as a theater performer and someone who performs not only on television and on stage, you know, there's such a craft to each type of genre. Mm-hmm. There's such a craft to each even genre of magic. Card magic, mentalism. I mean, they all have their things that you need to know to be able to do well in order to make that stuff look good.
Right, right.
And so there's a balance, though, to learning magic, implementing it, rehearsing it, putting it out, putting it on stage, putting it on YouTube, putting it on television. And, it's definitely a lot of time spent in rooms working on ideas that you're just like, I hope this looks good.
Right.
Because I watched you do magic right in front of my face when I was the producer for the morning show. You would come in.
Yeah.
And I would be filming it, and I would be paying attention to try and figure out what the hell you were doing, and I still couldn't see it from 6 inches away.
And that's what's fun about it. That's like the best part about seeing magic live and not seeing it on YouTube, right?
Right.
Or not seeing it on TV, is that it's so much, obviously, it's way more impressive to see it live, you know? And I think it shows you technically how crazy some of this stuff can look in your eyes, you know,
and
fool your brain. But
so growing up in Pittsburgh, you know, like we were talking before we started recording, I had an uncle who my uncle Morgan. Shout out to my uncle Morgan.
Uncle Morgan, what up?
And always fascinated in magicians and magic, and would take me as a small kid. I mean, I'm, you know, under 10, to this place in Pittsburgh called the Cuckoo's Nest.
Oh yes,
right. Which
my home away from home.
Yeah, I don't know if people might remember this. I mean,
on the south side.
Yeah.
Yeah, do you remember it?
I used to go in there all the time and be totally intimidated.
It was originally in Brentwood at one time, years, years ago. And then it moved to south side right on that 15th, right across from Barrios. And I spent a lot of my childhood there from 10 to 15. I was there all the time.
Wow.
Buying new magic tricks, learning new stuff. But it was when I was 16 when I got my license, you know, and I had that like freedom to like go wherever I wanted. And normally you'd think I'd want to go hang out with my friends at the mall, but I didn't. I wanted to go be a demonstrator. I wanted to be a magician demonstrator at the Cuckoo's Nest. And so I hit them up, and you know, they had known me already from being there literally every weekend. And they were like, "Hey, when you're ready, we'd love to have you."
That's awesome.
I started doing magic there as a demonstrator, a couple times a week. But I did it for 4 years.
Wow.
So I was there for 4 years. I probably sold you some stuff.
Probably. I was going to say, somehow. We must have somehow connected, you know?
Yeah.
Very cool. Very cool stuff.
The Cuckoo's Nest was definitely my, that was my home away from home. And then when it closed down a couple years ago, I had felt like, in a way, I lost my home in Pittsburgh. My, you know, that hangout that I had, that camaraderie that comes with being a magician in this city and there being other magicians and us all kind of talking and hanging out at times at that location.
Right.
And so when that disappeared, that felt like the we lost that. And so when the cultural trust, when they had came to me just recently last year and wanted to pursue the idea of magic with me in the city, and how we could work together, I saw this as a grand opportunity to create a new home for Pittsburgh with magic. And that was how Liberty Magic came to be.
Yeah. I mean, that's the most fantastic thing is how you realize the history of magic and the importance of a place like the Cuckoo's
Nest. Absolutely. Yep.
And what that meant to kids like yourself, me, all of us in this room.
Yeah.
And and how to continue that somehow successfully.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, I applaud you for that.
Thank you, man. Yeah. The economy was at that time, it took out a couple, all those brick and mortar magic shops. And so now that I think the interest at Renaissance is back in magic and people are, you know, are finding it and really, you know, and wanting to see it. It was just such a great combination of time for me because I wanted to be back in Pittsburgh doing magic full time here in the city instead of being on the road. Because I did a decade on touring around the country, around the world, doing magic constantly. And so that wore me out after a decade of doing hundreds of shows. And so it was in 2015 when I was like, hey, to my manager and my agent, like, hey, guys, I'm going to come back to Pittsburgh and I'm going to start doing these residencies.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to do this crazy stunt in 2016. Mm-hmm. And then we'll see what happens. And so that's kind of how it happened. And then to have, you know, the Trust, which is the, you know, the major player in the city when it comes to the theaters, having them put their trust in me and in putting the art of magic in something they want to pursue and put money behind and bring to their theater district. I was shocked and I was honored to be a part of that process.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I have a lot of big plans for that, not only that location, but for magic in Pittsburgh, too.
Oh, wow.
So I got some cool things working.
It's an amazing scenario because I remember going to the Ground Round in Moon Township.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And they would have magicians
there.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And I would see people like Mike Super.
Yep.
And there was another gentleman whose name eludes me at the moment, but we would go.
Mm-hmm.
They would give us a flyer and say, hey, we're going to be at North Catholic High School next week. Come see the magic show.
And they would do the magic show. Yeah.
And we would go.
I was on one of those, I think.
Oh, yeah. And it was amazing.
Yeah.
And so what I would like to know about is it's not just you. I mean, you're the cream of the crop.
I'm doing it here now. I'm staying busy here in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of guys from history of Pittsburgh.
Yeah, can you talk about the guys?
Absolutely, because those are the guys that, like, I love. I mean, they're the reason why I'm doing what I'm doing. And the one big name that came out of Pittsburgh early on was a magician by the name of Del Rey. Del Rey was, like, a phenomenal, like, sleight-of-hand artist from Pittsburgh, very suave and sophisticated and classy. He would play corporate events, and he would do country clubs around the country. But he was from Pittsburgh, and he was known as one of the best sleight-of-hand artists in the world. Now, after him came a magician by the name of Paul Gertner. Now, Paul, in a way, is very cut from the same cloth. Incredible sleight-of-hand magician. Went huge into the corporate world, but also tackled the trade show industry. So he was he became a magician that was, you know, always at these humongous trade shows around the country, working for, you know, the IBMs and, you know, these big companies, making their booth at these trade shows like the best it could be, right? But he was also a world champion sleight of hand artist, and he'd had a few appearances on the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, and he actually became he was Johnny Carson's personal magic teacher. So magician.
That's right, because
Carson loved magic. Carson was a magician before he was ever a TV host. He was obsessed with magic. And that's why so much magic appeared on The Tonight Show when he was the host. And Paul was on it three times over the years. And so he would go out to LA and go to his home in Hollywood and would just sit there and jam and talk magic tricks with Johnny Carson. And like that's crazy.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and that's Paul. And Paul was my mentor. And so I got to, you know, when I was coming up as a young kid, my connection to Paul was absolutely kind of crazy because my connection is actually my godmother dated him in high school. So whenever
Pittsburgh,
Paul,
man.
Exactly, it's such a damn small city. And so whenever Paul was doing a show of his show, Ten Fingers, back in, like, I think it was like 1994 or something, and it was at the City Theater, and I was a young kid, and my godmother, I was a magician at that time, but my godmother took me to meet Paul Gertner at that show. Now, at the time, I think Paul was like, oh, cool, like, you know, nice young kid that's in the magic, that's great. Why the hell is my ex-girlfriend from high school standing here? You know what I mean? But she was so, you know, she was like working it. She was like, no, I want you to, you got to show Lee, you could take him under your wing and maybe show him a couple tricks. And Paul was so nice. You know, he invited me to his office. He gave me his book. And more or less, like, we became best friends. You know, we became pals. And over time, it grew into definitely like a very strong relationship.
That's amazing. I mean, and you basically encapsulated it. in that story because Pittsburgh is such a small city.
Yeah.
Because everybody knows everybody. But I don't think we realize how important magic is. I mean, now you're selling out shows. You're selling out multiple shows, doing your Houdini show, your sleight of hand show. And you did the 52
Up Close at Hotel Monaco. And then my comedy magic show was like a, that I do at Liberty. It's called In Plain Sleight. That was like kind of my touring comedy show, comedy magic show that I worked in the college market with for quite a few years. That was like that act. And then when I was doing, bringing this deal together with the trust to bring a new show, to bring a show to Pittsburgh, I couldn't do the show that I was doing at Hotel Monaco. You know, that show was built for that location. And so I more or less just went to that, all that other material that I had, and I kind of repackaged it and brought it to Liberty Magic in that way. And then it was getting into Liberty Magic and seeing how well magic was being, you know, received in this city that I went, you know, when I was talking to Trust about, you know, what, you know, our next run together of when I would be doing another run of shows, that was when I was like, hey, I want to go film this documentary this summer about Harry Houdini. I want to look, you know, I got all these crazy connections. I'm going to set this thing up. I'm going to go hang out with David Copperfield and do this thing in Harry Houdini's home. But I was like, once I get all this information, I'll build a show around it, and it can be all an entire performance about Harry Houdini. And I was talking to these guys about this idea. I was like, yes, I'm going to part my hair for this show down the middle. I'm going to into that entire, you know, character. And that's what I had to do, but I was able to take all the knowledge that I had gained from that creating that documentary and shooting it, and I was able to like drop all those tidbits of information into this character and present it to an audience each night on stage, and do the straitjacket escape with me hanging upside down in the theater, which was all based around being inside Harry Houdini's home in New York.
Well, could you give us just a quick synopsis of where this came from and what it really is,
sure,
the Houdini show?
Yeah, okay. So when I was out shooting this documentary, I went to the Magic Castle in Hollywood, and I met up with my buddy John Cox, who is a Houdini historian. And it was talking to John, I showed him a photo of Harry Houdini that was taken, that I ended up finding out was taken in Harry Houdini's house. And once I found out that this iconic photo of Harry standing against this bookcase, right, this really big bookcase with all these books filled in it, and I was like, you know, John, where was this at? And he goes, oh, this was at Houdini's home in New York in Harlem. And then that led me into doing more research on that home, 278 West 113th Street in Harlem. And I came to find out that bookcase was still in that, you know, when Harry passed on, that bookcase is still stayed in that house.
Really?
Like that.
Wow.
So it lived on in a way, even when the new owners came in and took over that residence, right? Mm-hmm. They never changed it. And so what happened was, is I found out that bookcase ended up disappearing out of that living room. Go figure.
Wow.
Houdini's house.
Right.
Yeah, a bookcase
exactly.
Disappears out of it. Well, where does a gigantic bookcase disappear when it sold in 2016?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we came to find out that it reappeared in the one place that no one else could ever get to it, in David Copperfield's secret
right.
warehouse
yeah.
in the Las Vegas desert. And that's where, and so David was able to negotiate because he, once there was photos put online of the interior of the home on Zillow is how
right.
they figured this out.
Yeah.
They were able to see that that bookcase still existed. And so
wow.
that was when Copperfield swooped right in.
The realtor got a call from David Copperfield.
Was like, I want that bookcase. How much do you want for it? And that was how it was done.
Wow.
And so it then disappeared and went to his warehouse in Las Vegas. So when I was, you know, finding that information from John and then finding out that the bookcase is now in Houdini's museum, I was thinking to myself, like, well, then I got to go talk to David Copperfield.
Yeah.
You know, like
yeah.
how, and so I knew what would be super cool to me. And that was taking my buddy, George Hardine, who is a Houdini. He's a, you know, a descendant of Harry. He's the
right.
great grandnephew of Harry Houdini. And me knowing what a, you know, super fan Copperfield is of Harry Houdini. I was like, you know what? What are the odds if I could put him and those two in the room together? How cool
right.
would that be? What would happen?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I did. I invited George. I said, hey, let's link up in Vegas, man. I'm working on this documentary. I want to sit you down and I want to get you on camera and talk about our experience together and Harry. And
right.
and of course, my my ulterior motive was to take him to the show and kind of like let him see David Copperfield live, because he would essentially be seeing what his uncle or his great uncle was today.
Yeah, it was prime. Yeah, exactly.
David Copperfield is today's Houdini in a way. You know, he's the most famous magician in the world. And so that is what George and I and a couple of my friends, we all linked up in Vegas and we did this. And after the show, arranged for a meet and greet with George and David and myself. And David was blown away by meeting George Hardine. He couldn't get over the fact that how much he looked like Harry Houdini.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I saw your photos.
He looks a lot like
him.
He does. And so that was when David was like, "Well, I got to show you guys this. Come with me." And he took us to his museum in the secret warehouse and proceeded to just blow our minds with like incredible history and magic and just, you know, all these Houdini artifacts. And he let us see the mirror cuffs. He let us see the water torture cell, the real one.
Right.
He has the wax cylinders that have the only known recording of Harry Houdini's voice in existence.
Wow.
He played it for us.
Wow.
And it was finding out all these really interesting things talking to David, because I had said to David, I said, you know, the bookcase, when you got it, what's up, you know? Mm-hmm. And the reason why I was asking quite a few questions about the bookcase is because I had heard about a rumor that from John Cox that was that when Harry Houdini lived in the home in 278 back in 1920s, he installed wires behind the bookcase that he could listen to his friends and family in his living room from his top floor in his house.
Wow.
And he could use the information that he was learning. Like he would, you know, pick up a couple things. He could use that information, or he could do tricks where he could have people come up with something. He'd be upstairs listening.
Right, right.
But this was 1926. No one thought that he had a listening device, you know what I mean? Of that magnitude, like hidden behind a wall or behind a bookcase in his house. Mm-hmm. And so when I was with David, I said, when you received the bookcase, did you find any of these wires? And he said, no. And I was like, oh man, like, I guess that rumor's kind of like, no, you know, not real then. Obviously it's just a rumor. And so when I went to New York City for the last part of this documentary to film, I was with a guy at the Houdini Museum in Manhattan in New York. And after my interview with Roger Dreyer, my phone rang and it was John Cox. And he said, from LA, and he said, Lee, he goes, are you still in New York? And I was like, I'm still here, buddy. Why? He goes, well, the owners of 278 West 113th Street, Harry Houdini's home, have said that they'll allow you into their house.
Wow.
And I was like, get out of here. I'm going to get to tour Houdini's home. And not only that, they let me bring the camera crew in.
Oh,
so I got
okay,
to bring
good.
My cameras in and film the entire home. And when we were going throughout the house, they were showing me everything. But I was told before I got there that the house was under construction. Which to me, I was like, oh, kind of bummed because it's like not going to look super pretty.
Mm-hmm.
But it came to be a blessing in disguise, because when we got in there, the first place I wanted to go was the living room where that bookcase was.
Right.
And sure enough, they had recently just blown out the wall.
Hmm.
And because they're, you know, these people that now own it are, they love the home so much, they're going to restore it back to when Harry lived there in 1926, which
nice.
Is amazing.
Yeah.
And so they're telling me, so now we get there and they're like, oh yeah, everything's under construction. Sorry, there's dust everywhere. And he's like, we're in the living room where the wall's blown out. And I go, hey man, is this where the bookcase was? And he goes, yeah, oh yeah, this is it. I go, did you find any wires? And he goes, well, let's look. And we're looking,
wow.
and we find these crazy wires that are
really?
In
the wow.
behind the wall. And he's talking. He goes, yo, you know what? The construction people were asking me about these.
Hmm.
He goes, they don't have any reason to be here.
Right.
And we're going, well, I'm going, I know there's a reason. There's a reason.
Right. Yeah.
And of course, talking to John Cox and, you know, and him talking to David Copperfield and like everybody kind of like figuring it all out. It's true. Harry bugged his house
with
his living
cool
room. Yeah, it was amazing to find out, and that's all part of the documentary. So, but that encapsulated what I created for the live show of The Life and Death of Harry Houdini.
Wow.
And we think you're going to work on this for
a bigger
audience.
It's a show that I have a couple options with it at the moment. I'm getting options to either tour it, to take it to other cities because it's such a character piece, and it can, in a way, Houdini magic can play anywhere in the world. So there's the potential to, one, take it on the road. Two is to, in a way, some way, create it into a TV series, which is always a possibility. The reason why I wrote it was because when I was in high school, I remember coming and seeing on a field trip downtown, I came and seen Tom Atkins perform the play The Chief.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember sitting in that audience and thinking to myself, like, I love this. This is incredible. Like,
right.
The guy wrote an entire play about, you know, the owner of the Steelers, Art Rooney. I'm going, this guy's going to kill it with this show. He's going to run this every, he's going to do this every year for right. a decade. And of course they have, mm-hmm. you know, and they've done that for quite some time.
And they came out with a movie.
And then they came out with a movie with it, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like all this branding behind it. I was like, it's so smart. And I always said to myself, if there's ever an opportunity for me to create a one-man show that I can run every year for one time a year for an entire decade, I'm going to do it. And then when I saw the Houdini idea starting to come together, I looked at that as my chief, you know, mm-hmm. I was like, I can create that. I can make that into a show that I can bring back every October and it'll always be kind of like this interest in it mm-hmm. because of Harry's association with Halloween and his right. death on Halloween. And
I remember living in Los Angeles. I lived at the corner of Hollywood and Wilcox and like maybe four yeah, blocks yeah. down yes. or something yep. was the Portnoy mm-hmm. Hotel.
Mm-hmm.
So I used to like wander around there on Halloween and be like, you know, look to the roof because yeah. apparently that's the
they did
the,
some
the
seances
place.
There. Yeah, they did.
The only thing I heard, the only real creepy history really is that William Flatley or Fred Mertz from I Love Lucy had a heart attack in the lobby of that
no
hotel.
Way.
Yeah, that's wow. where he died. It's also where Francis Farmer went insane and was like dragged out in her underwear in like the 1930s Hollywood. Yeah.
Well, him and Ethel hated each other, by the way. I don't know if you
oh,
knew
yeah,
that.
Yeah. But enough on I Love Lucy
for a future podcast.
So what is it about Houdini's challenge to himself that inspired you to recreate the same dangerous challenges?
Yeah.
I know it's a hard question to answer, but like, is there something, do you see yourself parallel with him?
No.
And to the fact that you want to challenge yourself to do it.
No, I saw what he did, and I saw the genius behind it. Mm. It was how he created these things was so smart, and how he marketed them was even smarter. And I had such an incredible respect. I mean, I went to college for marketing. That mm-hmm. was my study. I studied show business in a way. And that was the best tip I got from my mentor, Paul Gardner. He told me, he's Lee, he goes, you're an incredible magician. He goes, but if you want to have a career, learn the business of what you do. Right. And that was why I went to Robert Morris and got a degree in marketing and business. And that's what Houdini was the best at. He was a good magician, very good magician, an incredible thinker and inventor,
mm-hmm.
but he was an incredible marketer.
Oh, yeah.
And it was all those things that I loved. And so wanting to do those, like creating the upside down straitjacket escape, that came from me, you know, getting a straitjacket when I was 15 and putting that piece of magic, obviously, from Harry Houdini into right. my act, but kind of as I did it as a comedy bit because I was a comedy guy
mm-hmm.
and I would do it more comedically and it was never like a serious like stunt.
Well,
you know?
Like Lethal Weapon, like Mel Gibson,
dislocate the arm, the right. shoulder, stuff like yeah. that. No, I saw it as more of a performance piece yeah. in that aspect and not as like a scare the hell out of you piece.
Right, right.
And it wasn't until I really started working on Houdini 100 where I had to take it and invert it and put it upside down and put it over the city of Pittsburgh mm-hmm. where I was thinking to myself, this is going to scare the hell out of people because I was telling it to my friends and family and they think I'm crazy.
Well, they're did like, it scare you?
It didn't. No, it right. didn't. That's what that was funny. It was like, I just saw it as like, oh, this is going to be fun.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I was like, this is going to be a blast. Like, I can't wait to do this thing. I just hope it doesn't rain. You know, that's right. that was the one thing I just didn't want to have happen. I didn't want it to just get screwed up by a weather.
Mm-hmm.
And because I knew how much time and effort was going to go into it and creating it and what it was going to take to market it and what it was going to take to train. Mm-hmm. Because there was a lot of training that went in it too, you
of
know,
course.
From inversion therapy to just being back in the gym and eating right and doing all the right stuff so that when the big day did come and I had to replicate that performance, I didn't screw it up. You know
right,
what I mean?
Right, yeah.
I wanted to do it justice. And it's funny, the one thing people always ask me is, if you, you know, were you scared or were you nervous? And I always say, no, I wasn't, because I had played that damn routine out 1,000 times in my head before I'd done it.
Mm.
And I just wanted to do it. The only thing that I was nervous about that day on the 6th was that when they secured me in the straitjacket and they put my feet in and they started pulling me up,
mm.
that was when I realized in my head, as I'm going up, I was like, oh, crap. I couldn't remember if I secured the terrible towel in my back pocket.
Right.
Because that was my finale, right? And I'm whipping out that terrible towel and I'm going,
just like Houdini did.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, right? Yeah. And I'm thinking to myself, oh, my God, if this falls out of my back pocket while I'm hanging up there, people are going to chastise me for the rest of my life for desecrating the terrible towel.
Right, right.
You know, for letting it fall all the way to the ground like that.
Yeah.
And so that was one of the most, you know, that was the only
thing
that
Franco
would have
picked
me. Franco would have caught it. He would have caught me if I would have fell, too. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that was, but replicating his stunts is something that, you know, it just comes with the territory. If you're going to do anything about Harry Houdini,
right.
you got to be willing to put yourself in his same position.
Oh, yeah, but now what do you think it is about magic per se, because it is entertainment value of it, not necessarily, you know, feats of strength or feats of
sure.
You know,
it's a curiosity, man. It's a curiosity of the mind. Yeah. People love being fooled, right. and I think magic, you know, along with technology, and that's the fight. You know, we're trying to stay ahead of it, and for audiences to come see you live and you to do stuff with just simple objects is what will blow people's minds the best.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the thing I was gonna say is. Like the circus, Barnum and Bailey, that's gone, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Newspapers are fading away. All these vaudeville type things are fading away, but magic,
magic is
not
going strong.
Going anywhere.
And I think that has a lot to do with the fact that people have cell phones, right? And we all have these things and we can constantly watch YouTube. And if you've looked in the past so many years, look at all the acts that are winning all the shows on television. Look at all the acts that are like constantly getting featured. It's magic.
Yeah.
You know, AGT, so many magic shows. You know, so many magicians on that show.
Well, Penn and Teller have their own show.
Penn and TNT have a show dedicated to just fooling them.
Right.
You know, me performing a show dedicated just to Harry Houdini. You know, I mean, to have this many magic shows popping up on television is, like I said, it's a new renaissance period for this art.
Well, I remember, you know, when we were kids, you know, David Copperfield was like, I mean, you get Harry Anderson. You
sure,
know,
I loved Harry Anderson.
Oh, yeah. I loved his name on Cheers. He was
Harry the Hat.
You know,
Harry the Hat.
Exactly.
Yeah,
Night Court, you know,
loved
and all
it.
That. But
I got to meet him one time.
Really?
One time.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow. That's
I saw
the way.
Him at the Magic Castle when
saw
I lived there in 2001.
Cool.
I saw him way back then.
I saw him at the Funny Bone.
It's very
wow.
upset when
in
he
Pittsburgh.
Passed away.
Yeah, yeah, man, I was a hard
or like,
day for me too.
Same people like Max Marvin, you know,
Max Maven.
Max
Maven,
yeah, and his mind tricks. You
oh
know,
yeah, yep.
and all that. But
Kreskin,
of course,
the amazing Kreskin, man. Yeah,
he's still
around.
He's
man.
Still
he's,
trying.
He's still yeah, killing yeah. it too.
But the fascination. I remember seeing Dave. I saw Dave Copperfield here in Pittsburgh when he came to a tour.
Yeah, he did
the
flying. He did the flying illusion, and that was at the Civic Arena, if I remember. Was it the arena?
I can't remember if it was there or the Heinz or Heinz Hall
he's
or one
played
of those
both.
Places. Yeah,
he's played both, and I remember being at that performance too, and being like, "How the hell?
Yeah, I'm like,
is
what
that
is
dude
going
flying
on?"
Around
it was,
this
it
place?
Was him yeah. and David Blaine. Those were like the two that I know that had specials.
Sure, yeah.
like
so David,
insane.
David
specials.
Murdered the 80s and the 90s, and it was in 1998 when David Blaine put out the Street Magic special. That was when like his decade took off,
because
like he owned the early 2000s with what he, with all the magic that he was putting out.
And the other one is Chris Angel.
Yeah. Chris Angel came in kind of, you know, mid 2000s with his show Mind Freak on A&E.
That was something that I'd never missed.
I know.
I don't know why.
But,
like,
and you know what? That was kind of like the birth of the viral video in a way, because if you remember, I remember there Chris Angel doing this really, in a way, not the best magic trick, where he ripped a woman in half. You see this thing? But it became a viral video.
Where was she on a bench?
Yeah, she was on a bench.
Yeah,
bench
yeah.
Sure
yeah.
And it was like,
one, yeah.
And from a magic standpoint, you're like, oh, all right. You know.
Well,
but at the same time, it was like shock magic.
Yeah.
And that was what he was promoting. And was what, and it was like, that was so good.
Well, can you write this moment float for us?
No. I need 7 years and like 12
exactly.
million to develop it.
Right.
So how... When you see somebody like Chris Angel or David Blaine do a like a magic trick or illusion, as Job would say, do you know how they do it, or do you still get
99.9% of the time I know how it's done? Yes.
Like I've seen Chris Angel walk through a plate glass window.
Uh-huh.
Could you do that if you had the time? And
sure.
The...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Could you walk through the Great Wall of China too?
I guess Copperfield did that. Yeah,
yeah he did.
It's funny. It's so funny because I'm in TV world and writing writing episodes for television shows that I might be starring in it someday. And it's like write up all your what magic trick would you do at this point, Lee? And it's like it's funny. Just the other day I was writing I would walk through a brick wall because that was a trick that Harry created.
It was exactly.
You know? And of course it's been, and then. To watch other magicians put their own spins on it, like Copperfield with doing with the great with the heartbeat and the Great Wall, and then Chris Angel taking it to like doing it through a plate glass window, and all it's just like you're just reinventing the wheel.
Right.
But the wheel was created by Harry Houdini, he's the one that came up with this stuff.
Wow!
So that's why I think it's so cool to go back to the guy that created it, and to be challenged with doing it today. But under the circumstances, like when I did Houdini's Last Secrets with Discovery, the challenge was to do everything with only the apparatuses that he would have had at that point in time. You know, he didn't have Google and YouTube. He didn't have, you know, his phones to look up anything. We only had, like, if we were, when we were doing the bullet catch on the show, we made sure we were using a time period gun. You know, when we were using the transportance.
I feel like that would be less safe.
Oh my God, it is. And that's how a lot of the guys died doing this stupid trick, the bullet catch.
Right.
And I openly tell people, like, I did the bullet catch on the show, but I'll never do it again in my career. I'll never touch it again. It's just a trick that I don't want to be associated with ever again, and mainly because it's history behind it. It's killed 13 people on stage.
Oh yeah.
So 13 guys went up on stage, tried to do this for a live audience, and died doing it. Right. And the audience had no clue that, like, you know, they thought it was part of the show. He gave him a standing ovation, right?
Yeah.
And meanwhile, the guy's dead.
At least he went out on a standing ovation.
Went out on a standing ovation. But for me, you know, it's just too many things associated with that trick I just don't like, right? Yeah. And when Discovery was like, because I'm under contract with a major network, and they're going, here's our list of ideas we want you to do. And of course, I'm part of this. I'm part of this creative process. And I see Bullet Catch on there, and I'm like, it's not the one I'm really a fan of. But and of course, that's the one they pick.
Right.
And sure enough, as we're leading up to it, and I'm working out everything that has to do with this dumb trick, you get to the day where you have to film it, right? And that's a big moment in my career to have to do this trick that's associated with so many, you know, magicians that have perished doing it, and knowing that we're using a time period gun, that, you know, something could go wrong. And like, anytime you're standing and you're playing with a live ammunition and you're playing a live gun, I mean, there is always that slight chance that something could happen.
I mean, look at Brandon Lee, you know?
Yes, Brandon Lee died doing a stunt in a movie, and just was, you know, with blanks.
Exactly.
Got killed by a blank.
And
now we're using a time period gun. And sure enough, like, whenever it came for me, I knew the date we had to film this, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'd been dreading it for the entire, you know, there was the one trick I was not looking forward to doing on the show. I was looking forward to doing Buried Alive. I was looking forward to doing a Trinitarian transcape. I was looking forward to doing the water torture cell. I was not looking forward to doing the bullet catch. And the day I woke up to do the bullet catch, I woke up to the news on Twitter, just like every other Pittsburgh did in the city. I woke up the same day of the Tree of Life massacre in the city of Pittsburgh. Yeah, that was the day I woke up. Watching, you know, what was happening in the city of Pittsburgh, and me being on set and having to do a trick like this,
right?
And it just, like, that is what threw me. What was going on in Pittsburgh threw me, and my director saw that, and he saw, because I kept coming over to him, going, "Man, can you believe this?" You know, like,
right.
And of course, I have to get in frame to be on camera and to do this crazy trick, you know, and of course, him being so smart. He came over to me, put his arm around me, said, "Hey, man, you know what? You're done for the day." He goes, "I don't like where the sun's at for shooting purposes and filming." He goes, "You're cut. We'll go back to your trailer, man. We'll pick it up at a later date." And I was like, "Oh, okay, cool, man." And I went back and immediately went back to social media and was calling home and was seeing what's going on. And, you know, and then I realized 2 days later why he did that. You know, I was like, "Wow, he saw that day was not my day. We shouldn't be doing this trick with Lee."
Right.
You know, Lee has bigger things on his plate. And so they shut it down. They shut down a TV, you know, production, which is thousands and thousands of dollars.
Right.
But they did that for me. And so I ended up filming the trick about 10 days. I think it was 10 days later. And I said after that, I was like, "I'll never do it again."
Wow.
So,
I mean, still the fact that you were willing and able to do it.
Yeah.
Was a feat in and of itself, you know.
Did that make you want to just try and get it over with after?
Yes,
the fact that they suspended
when they delayed the production on it, because then I, you know, it kind of all started to sink in even more over that time, and then I was just like, I just want to get this thing done with. Like, when can we film this thing?
Just real quick, like, I was in Disney World. It was the day I was leaving, and I pulled out my phone, and being in the news business, I get alerts and everything all the time, and just seeing like Officer Down and blah blah blah, and it was. It was jarring.
Yeah, it was like, wow, it's hitting
home. Can't even imagine the trick that you were going to do.
I'm involving a gun. Yeah. I'm thinking, you know, I have to catch a bullet in my face, in my mouth. I was already like kind of on edge about this stupid trick because of the history behind it. You know,
I mean, that keeps
it in your brain. You're like, this, people die doing this. This isn't the illusion of danger. This is danger, and there is no round two. You don't get a second shot at this. And so knowing that, you know, that was what was really playing on me. And, you know, and then to wake up that morning and to just be to have my confidence blown and just, you know, not being, you know, just not having my brain in the frame of mind to being on in a, you know, on television.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it was just one of those experiences that I'm glad that they made that call and did it the right way.
Yeah.
Because,
yeah,
you know, sure. An accident could have happened.
Oh, so. Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad you survived.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you could be here because, I mean, these things really are dangerous.
They
I mean,
are,
it's not
absolutely.
Like it's not dangerous. Yeah. They go in a
water torture,
you know,
cell.
Water torture cell.
Yeah, that, I mean, you're yeah. holding your breath underwater upside down with your feet locked in yeah. very little room to go anywhere. I mean, yeah, if you screw up, if you succumb to the pressure of mm-hmm. that moment and I lose that breath and I'm filled up with water, mm-hmm. they're coming in with axes to chop me out of there.
Right.
And I did have a safety team nearby at all times to if that had happened,
mm-hmm.
and everybody was prepared for if I screw up,
right.
they're coming in to save my life.
Right.
Now, obviously, I'm very thankful that they're there to do that, but I also knew that the network had paid 10 grand to make that water torture cell,
right.
and that would be an expensive screw up on their part. So,
right.
Yeah, it was just it's that process though of like being in putting yourself in these situations where you know that you are comfortable in your experience and knowing what you're about to do, but at the same time knowing that it could go wrong.
And it's a little bit like professional wrestling,
absolutely,
in the sense that. Obviously, the outcome is predetermined,
mm-hmm.
but people are still jumping
almost,
20
yeah,
feet
really
off
is.
Of a cage
yeah.
or
yes.
something.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very much.
Yeah, Mankind style. You
yeah,
know?
No.
Undertaker. But yes, yeah, that is. I mean, yeah. it really is. It's kind of like a, you
it's
know,
a leap
art.
Of faith.
Yeah, it's art and the danger that goes along with it is, mm-hmm. I think, with the thrill.
That's the thrill.
Of, you know,
and that's why
yeah.
people show up to see you dangle upside down in the city.
Right.
Because it's like, well, what if you fall?
Yeah, exactly.
Franco's got to be there to catch you.
That's right. That's right. That's right. You know? Well, I appreciate you coming in.
Yeah, absolutely,
I appreciate you
man.
Talking magic with us.
For sure.
Thanks,
you
man.
Know? And
you're one of the best.
Thanks, man.
Anytime
you guys want to have me, I'm always down to come down and talk tricks, talk history. I'm a huge history buff. I love, obviously, the magic of this city. But, you know, there's so many different things. I love sports of the city. But my fascination with Houdini and Pittsburgh have always been tops for me. I've always loved. And I love what you brought up to me today about that quote and the 7th Street Bridge.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
being one of the things that he almost screwed up. In his career, I didn't, that was something I didn't know. So you brought
well,
something
you
new
go.
To me, man.
All right. But yeah, that, I mean, that's the best thing about history is that you're always going to come across something you didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
You
yeah.
know, I didn't know that 1897 Houdini came here. That surprised me today.
Yeah, that was interesting too. I was not, I wasn't familiar with that one, which is now added to the list because I knew about all the ones from that 1906 date and through 1925 and all the, you know, he played the Grand and the Alvin and the Davis Theaters and, oh, he even played the Carnegie Music Hall. I forgot about that one.
Yeah.
Very cool. Yeah, it's, he was a fascinating man and like an incredible entertainer for his time. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was the biggest name in the world. So,
well, you're definitely the biggest name of magic in Pittsburgh.
Well, thank you, man.
Sure.
I appreciate that.
You're working on the world.
We're working. So, we're going bigger. We're going bigger.
Let me know when you play the ground round and see Mike
Super. I played a lot of
restaurants again.
Coming up, man. I did Pizza Hut's was my first gig.
There you go.
That was my first
but,
gig.
But yeah, I do appreciate it, and I do feel that your legacy has not gone unnoticed.
Thanks, man. Thank
you know,
you so much.
And that you're not. People will remember the 100th anniversary of Houdini doing that same feat, but remember you doing it.
Well, I hope,
you know,
and I've said this,
I hope
somebody 100 years from now, well, I guess it would be, 3 years later, so 97 years from now, I hope some kid discovers this podcast
right.
and hears me say, I hope, do the straitjacket escape on the anniversary.
Well, yeah, challenge
yourself. Recreate
it
again.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's go,
our numbers
let's go for
going.
Another 100.
Yeah.
Is there anything you'd like to promote?
You know what? Let's just promote Liberty Magic. You know, I got a lot of really creative magicians that are going to be coming through and playing that new theater. Other than that, I'm going to be taking some time off stage for a moment as I work on some other projects. I just finished up my 16 weeks of magic.
Wow.
I split it up 8 and 8 over this year at Liberty Magic with In Plain Slight and The Life and Death of Harry Houdini. But Life and Death of Harry Houdini will be back at some point in time, likely next October at Liberty Magic. 52 Up Close will be back at some point in time in 2020. And look for some new TV stuff coming out too.
Exciting, man. So
that's it, Fort Pitt.
I was going to say, can you do it in like a magical way?
No, I can't.
Thank you.